Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and it's good to be with you. There are soldiers enlisting in the U.S. Armed Forces today who were not alive when the War on Terror began. Today we'll listen to America at War, the human and social costs of 2 decades of fighting, a conversation between Brian Mockenhaupt and Dan Stockman, recorded at the Main Library in downtown Fort Wayne. Mockenhaupt is a veteran and journalist who has written for years about military and veteran affairs. The moderator for America at War is Dan Stockman, a writer for the National Catholic Reporter and a writing instructor at Indiana Tech and the University of St. Francis. During the first part of this program, we are going to hear a story about a former Marine. Brian Mockenhaupt wrote about him in a piece called "The Mountains Weren't Enough for Marine Dan Seidels." And a word of warning. During this hour, we'll be hearing about the experiences of combat, the casualties of war, and veteran suicides. It may not be appropriate for all listeners. Dan Stockman will begin the conversation shortly. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it. Also, I want to thank Steve for making this happen. He was really a driving force to get this done. Thank you to Brian, because when I first approached him with the idea, his response was, "No way." And he wasn't smiling in joke. He said, "No way." Before we get going, I need to know, we are talking about soldiers, we're talking about combat, and we are talking about suicide. It's not nice, but it also shouldn't be. It's important. It's important we don't sugarcoat it. So, October issue of Outside Magazine was this big story about Dan Seidels. So, tell us who Dan Seidels is. Why? Who is this guy?
Dan was a Marine. He grew up in rural Iowa. After a year at community college, his life wasn't going where he wanted it to, and he joined the Marines, and he found a home there, found a lot of support, kind of that brotherhood that a lot of people find in the military. And then within a year, he was in Kuwait for the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and he served a couple months, and then he went back a year later for a second tour, which was the first battle of Fallujah in Anbar province, the most intense urban fighting since the Battle of Hue in Vietnam. So he had served that, and then he came home, and then he had struggled kind of finding his place back home and making sense of where he had been and what had happened to him and what there was for him at home and how he could connect with other people. And eventually, his case manager at the VA had asked him about climbing a mountain in the Himalayas, and that's how we had initially met. All right. It was the first story that I had written about that.
Before we get into that, you wrote that in many ways he was the ideal recruit for the Marines. What do you mean by that?
And Dan was big. He was physically imposing. He was strong, and he had a lot of allegiance to the people that he was around. Kind of exactly what you would want in a recruit. And like a lot of people who joined the military, he had come from a home life that wasn't the best.
And that's something unique in recent decades. Because we have an all-volunteer military, we tend to attract people, obviously there are exceptions, but it tends to attract people who don't have that great family support system, right? The kind of people that you say, "Man, I think the military will be really good for him," right? And that's where Dan was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's people, the military, it's a really broad institution, and it brings in all kinds of people. But the way that it's been in the all-volunteer force, the numbers are that the people who join the military in the all-volunteer force tend to have more experiences in childhood, what psychologists call adverse childhood experiences. And this was something that I've written about war and trauma for a long time. But this was new to me when I wrote about this story, was I just didn't realize the profound impact that childhood experiences have on our experiences as adults and can really exacerbate adult trauma. So you have people who join the military are twice as likely to have had adverse, you know, childhood experiences, whether it's it could be a parent in prison, it could be being belittled at home or being subjected to physical abuse. There's several different things. And for a lot of people, that's what the military is. It can be a way, out of that, a way to pay for college, a way to go out and experience parts of the world that you might not have been able to otherwise. And for some people, and in Dan's case, who grew up with, I guess you would call it kind of emotional abuse and neglect. He was never made to feel like he was worthwhile and that he could accomplish things. He didn't have that support growing up, but he really found that in the military.
In fact, you quoted him, "A lot of people who join the military come from broken homes like me. I'm no exception." So you've got some anger. You can't deny that. It's there. And then the Marine Corps just adds to that. Seidel's felt bullied by his father and elder brother, and he considered terrorists the biggest bullies of all. So he channeled that anger. Friends who were injured or killed stoked the flames. Quote, "The fire just keeps burning and burning and burning," he said. "And then you come back here and try and put it out, and it's like impossible." So he comes back, and that support system that many people have, he doesn't have.
Yeah, and while he came back from his first tour, he still had the support of fellow Marines. You know, on his first day in the invasion, he was a gunner in a Humvee, and he was behind a 50 caliber machine gun and fired 1,000 rounds that first day. And then through the subsequent weeks of pushing up towards Baghdad, and he came home, but he had his other Marines around him to tell their stories and drink and get tattoos and just kind of revel in what they had done, but also process in different ways what had happened to them, but they still had each other. And then he went back for a second tour, which was in many ways harder than his first tour. But then after that, shortly after, he had gotten out, and then he was kind of, adrift without that support.
And that second tour is also something unique in recent decades. Vietnam, with the draft, you had one tour and you were done, unless you volunteered for more. And now, because it's hard to recruit, it's hard to get people to volunteer, people are being ordered to tour after tour after tour. That's not something we've seen before.
Well, these wars are also really long. They just don't end. I mean, with one in Iraq, but in Afghanistan, it kept going. And if you stay in the military for a while, you know, friends that, you know, have done 8, 9 tours, they just keep going. And that has all kinds of other secondary and tertiary effects on families, on children, on spouses, and, you know, it can ripple on and on.
Right.
But just the combat part of it.
And you're multiplying trauma on top of trauma as well, because you've got the childhood stuff and then a tour and then another tour.
Yeah, which I think can leave people, especially if those childhood traumas were unresolved, maybe not really dealt with. And same with adult trauma, as it's unresolved, it can really fester into something, you know, really insidious in someone's life.
All right, so the VA tells us that an average of 22 veterans a day are committing suicide. And you wrote, "Many of those who knew Dan thought they'd failed him." Had they? Had the VA failed him? Had the country failed him with its inability to understand what people like Seidel's lived through? But you also note that in his company, which is about 100 soldiers, right, 100 Marines, Dan, in the 10 years after they deployed, was the first suicide. They'd all been through the same stuff, but he was the first, and it was 10 years after. So it sounds like things are much more complicated than just soldier goes to war, sees intense combat, comes back, kills himself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you have other units that you read about that have almost like these suicide kind of clusters, that suicide just kind of tears through these units that they have one after another. Suicide and mental trauma in general, like it's such an incredibly complex thing, which it doesn't lend itself to easy solutions. That if you find a cure for a disease, it doesn't matter someone's background, the country they live in, and their culture upbringing, they could benefit from that vaccine or that treatment. But mental trauma and suicide, it's really tricky that you can have two people who are exposed to the exact same event. They can be in the same truck and the same bomb goes off, and they can have vastly different responses to it. And it can be, you know, what their belief systems are, their support networks, what kind of support they had after the event, but also what their previous experiences were, what kind of support network they had growing up, other trauma they had been exposed to, and then just things of their sort of nature and nurture, just their genetics. All of that can affect how someone is impacted by traumatic events.
And the VA said in their report, said something really interesting. Of the younger veterans that killed themselves, more than half were not deployed, right? So we have this image of guys who are committing suicide are people who served, saw heavy combat, right? But more than half were not even deployed, and of those who did deploy, many of them did not see heavy combat. So combat itself is not the only factor here.
Yeah, it's tricky with the statistics. Because, as you mentioned, sometimes in what you see at public service announcements with, they talk about 22 or 20 veterans a day, a lot of times it might be a young man or woman wearing, you know, desert camouflage, and sort of implies that might have served in one of the recent wars, and that's sort of the immediacy of problem in the population at hand that is, you know, recently experienced these things and may be going through this. But I think it's 65% of the veterans who die by suicide are over 50 years old, and that's not to say that they're might not be combat trauma related to that, because a lot of times it is. A lot of times trauma of whatever causes it. It could be, you know, sexual assault, it could be combat, it could be child abuse. A lot of these things just simmer at times unknown to the, you know, the people experience it, that they might not remember it or think, oh, that, yeah, I dealt with it and it wasn't, I'm good from that. But then later in life you could be, you know, you hear about, I've spoken with some veterans from Korea, veterans from World War II. They can be 80 years old, and all of a sudden they're not sleeping well. Maybe it's a death of a spouse, or they lose, they retire, and all of a sudden have all this time on their hands, and these things start coming up, and they start having these dreams like, oh my gosh, I haven't thought about this in 40 years. Or it could be terminal illness, or it could be, you know, a failed relationship. But most of the veteran suicides are older veterans, but as you say, like of the younger ones, half didn't deploy, and that could be some pre-existing things. It could be things from childhood, and you add some of the added pressures of military service. But of the ones that did deploy, it's not the majority that were involved in what you would, you know, consider kind of like heavy combat. But just deployments, it's stressful on people. It's stressful on their families. Stressful on kids. And then you come back and you're still trying to find your place about where and how you fit in. You know, the world's kind of been going on without you. I think people come back and they think, oh, the world's changed, and then they realize, which can be sort of more disorienting, that the world hasn't changed, society hasn't changed. It's doing exactly what it was. You've changed because of where you've been, because of what you've seen, and trying to make sense of who you were before, who you are now, how you do or don't connect with people.
There was a 2004 study that found that the grief from losing a buddy in combat is comparable to the grief experienced 6 months after losing a spouse. And that's 30 years later, right? So if you're like me and you go, wait a minute, 65% of suicides are over age 50, that's Vietnam era and before, how is this possible? But 30 years later, that grief is still intense. It's not just, it doesn't just go away.
Putting aside the other, the people who didn't deploy and the many reasons that might drive them to suicidal thoughts, and if we're just talking about people who experience combat, the term that's mostly used today, post-traumatic stress, in a lot of ways, you know, that sort of shapes the public's conception of this is what happens to service, you know, men and women when they go to war. And now you hear traumatic brain injury. But post-traumatic stress, in a way, it's too narrow of a definition through which to talk about the effects of it, because, you know, it implies that there's sort of the psychological trauma endured from being exposed to mortal terror. You think you're going to die, and your brain, the deep part of your brain that learned to, you know, run when a big animal is trying to eat you, and you flee from that fight or flight, and your brain is learning those lessons. You learn something that's so intense and it's such a great trauma that your brain sort of sears that deep into its neural networks, and it becomes sort of like an overreaction, or at the time, a very sensible reaction, but your brain has a hard time letting go of that. So you might have nightmares and flashbacks, and you avoid sort of crowded places, or you have a startle response that you hear a loud noise, and your brain immediately goes to, that's dangerous. That's dangerous. That might be a bomb. That might be something I need to protect myself from.
And you've talked about that startle response yourself.
Yeah, and when I came home, and I think for me, my body kind of flushed it out, and my brain could recognize, even though I would hear certain sounds, and my brain in half a second, like a fraction of a second, would just immediately say, that's automatic weapons fire. But then the other part of my brain, sort of the thinking part, could pull back and be like, wait, that doesn't make any sense, because you're at home and that's not, and so it was probably this or that or it's fireworks. But there's a lot of people that, you know, you experience a trauma that's bad enough, and your brain will keep you there. And so then people can be stuck there for a long time. But that's just a section of it, because you also have, like, to what you were talking about grief, that you hear more about it these days, something called moral injury. And it's loosely defined as being witness to or participating in something that kind of goes against your moral understanding of the way the world's supposed to work. It's war. Whatever you think about the act of killing, whether it's justified because of what one side is doing and the other, that's going to carry some effect. But also things you witness, you know, civilians being hurt and killed, or if there's something that you feel that you know, witness or are part of some betrayal. And it's not just combat. This happens a lot with military sexual assault. Women and men in the military, that there's someone who wears your uniform and they're supposed to be on your side and they're fighting beside you, and then you experience something like that. So people come home and they have this sense of either, and with guilt it could be, I should have been able to save that person. Is that a replaying of mortal terror? It might be if you were with them when it happened, but not necessarily. So there's all these other things that can happen to people that if you just talk about post-traumatic stress, that's part of it, but there's a lot of other things. And then you just look at readjustment, that people come home and they just walk through their days and think, no one around me knows what's going on in my head and where I've been and what I've seen. And as people separate from the military, then they're away from the people who do understand. And so if they're able to, they can stay in touch with, and they feel comfortable, you know, reaching out to people, and people check on them. But it's hard when they go from being in the barracks or being in the relative simplicity of a deployment, where all you have to do is wake up and stay alive and come home at night and go out the next day. But you're back in sort of the mundane world of 9-to-5 jobs and right, paying bills and sitting in traffic.
I want to kind of explore something. You talked about the changes in the deep parts of your brain during trauma. There's that fight or flight response hardwired in. At the same time, when you're in that situation, it's not just for a few seconds. It can be hour after hour after hour. And so you also have to find a way to kind of put that away. What does that do to someone's psyche where you are experiencing this intense fight or flight response, but putting it away? You still have to do your job.
Yeah, right. And it's all relative. It's relative to what someone has experienced in their life and what they think of that moment when they're experiencing terror. And so even among, you know, talking about service members, if your job is to be a finance clerk on a large military base in Iraq or Afghanistan, and a mortar round lands 50 yards away, it's a legitimate response. Like, is think, oh my gosh, what would have happened if that had landed on me? And you can have these reactions and these feelings, which can lead to post-traumatic stress, because if you felt mortal terror in that moment, where it's relative in context to what they're experiencing at the time.
Yeah, when there's gunfire all around, right, you've got to be able to say, that I'm not worried about, but that one I am.
Right. You have to, they have, just as a matter of doing their job and survivability, they have to be able to distinguish between what the threats are, but the threat level is so heightened all the time. But to your point, you're living with such a high level of adrenaline that even when you're going to sleep and waking up, there might not be a threat at that very moment, but you're living in a world of threat. And so coming back from that, coming back to a world where that isn't the case, you know, two things can kind of happen. You see threats where there aren't because of your brain is sort of sending the wrong signals because it's so cued into surviving that it's hearing a noise and thinking, you should really pay attention to that. That could be a big problem for you.
Right.
And then also, I think for a lot of these guys, like, some of the things they experience represent the worst things that happen in their lives, but also the things they miss the most. And it's just, I think a lot of combat veterans are uncomfortable with that. And there's plenty who, the day they get home and the day they take off their uniform, they think, thank goodness I am back, and I couldn't imagine being exposed to that, and there's nothing I want more than to forever bury that. But I know a lot of people who come back, and it is the most vital, exciting moments of life. Even if they didn't, doesn't matter if you believed in the mission or whatever you're doing, the overall strategic aims of it, but those moments, they're so unique.
And that adrenaline is addicting.
Yeah, and the adrenaline, also, it's like dope, you know, it's the brain drugs, the same thing that stays with you as a moment of terror, like you should remember this. It also sears itself in the brain as something that was, for better or worse, a moment of sort of deep and profound excitement. For Dan, this was definitely true, that he came home. And I think because of his, where he found purpose and because of how he had grown up, he was good at what he did. And that's where he felt the most needed, the most connected to the people around him, and the most, sounds weird to say, but the most alive in some ways, was in an environment where you might be very quickly not alive. And he came back from that and didn't have a place. He didn't have any safe harbor because there wasn't, he didn't know whether he would turn to them or not. A lot of people don't feel comfortable talking to family when they come back, but just knowing that you have this support network, knowing there's people who, look, we love you and we support you, and just that you know you have this safety net. He didn't have that. And he didn't have his life in the Marines, and that purpose was gone. And you grow up without sort of family support, and then you go, and the other part is taken away, that societal moral conceptions of this is how you should treat people, and if you're, you know, if you're lucky, your friends will, you will all live to an old age, and you won't see your friends lose limbs. But also, like one of the big ones, don't kill people.
Right.
If you're going to be a member of, you know, civilized world, don't kill people. And then you get put in an environment, like, that's exactly what you should do.
Right. And that conflict becomes really clear when you get back, right? That adrenaline rush, that dopamine that your brain feeds on, at the same time, you've got that moral questioning of, you know, all the stuff that I saw, did, experienced, but it was also this amazing experience. You wrote a piece called, I Miss Iraq, I Miss the War, I Miss My Gun. You said, I called some of my friends who are out of the Army now, and they miss the war too. Wells nearly died in Iraq. A sniper shot him in the head. Surgeons cut out half of his skull. He spent months in therapy, working back to his old self. Now he misses the high. I don't want to sound like a psychopath, but you're like a god over there, he says. McCarthy misses the war just the same. He saved Wells' life, pressing a bandage over the hole in his head. Now he's delivering construction materials in South Carolina. The monotony is killing me, he told me, en route to deliver some rebar. I want to go on a raid. I want something to blow up. So we have hundreds of thousands of people dealing with that very conflict right there of that was the closest I've felt to people, right? That brotherhood that so many people talk about, and also that moral ambiguity of, did I do the right thing? Should I have been there? Should this have happened? Right.
Yeah, and certainly not everyone feels that way, but a lot of people do, and it can be a hard thing to unwind from. You know, and you and I were talking about sort of other societies or past Native Americans, for instance, and you know, people come back from the fight and they would have cleansing ceremonies, but that's in a small, it's in a small group. You know, if you have a village of 100 people and 40 people come back and say, you need to go through this ceremony before, but they're very connected to war, much like
And in that
America.
Ceremony, too, there's also the collective responsibility,
yeah,
right, where they say, you did this in our name. You need to be purified, but so do we, because we sent you. Yeah. And that's very, very different yeah. than what our society does.
And in a way, I mean, it's a good thing that we don't need to have that many people in uniform and that we don't need to have that many people fighting wars. But if you look at World War II, the population was 140 million, about 14 million people were in uniform. That's 10% of the population. And the people were at home, like cities had blackouts and people worked in factories and there was rations
and war bonds
and everyone was, they were connected to it. And then when people came home, if you were around someone who was a military aged male, the legitimate question would have been like, where were you? Not, were you in the military? Because most likely, you know, they were in Europe or maybe they're in the Pacific. And so there was that sense of shared experience. And so everyone went on, they, you know, the GI Bill, went to college, made families, you know, built the suburbs. But even afterwards, as they were sort of, you know, it was a very different war. It didn't go on for, you know, two decades. That
right.
went on for a long time, and it was, you know, very hard fought, but that was relatively, it was, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, you can be old enough to enlist now and not have been alive when the War on Terror started.
Right. That's a long time. And so it's great that it's a good thing that our country does not need 10% of its population to be in uniform.
Right.
But one of the effects of that is that we get further and further removed from the costs of war. And so then, when you don't have a draft and you have an all-volunteer force and it's selective to certain demographics, and so it's not evenly distributed who is serving.
Yeah, and instead of 10%, it's more like 0.5%, yeah. right?
That's served in Iraq and Afghanistan,
right.
sure.
In my entire career, I've always been kind of fascinated by the paradox of numbers, right? I mean, that's incredibly low in context of World War II and other conflicts. But at the same time, 2.7 million people have served in Iraq and Afghanistan in the 18 years we've been there. I mean, 2.7 million people have served in country. That's the population of Chicago. That's an astounding number, right? And the VA says that a large percentage of those have some form of PTSD. And so, I mean, they're overwhelmed. Even though, compared to, say, Vietnam era, we've poured so many more resources. I mean, there's so many more things available to veterans, but it's nowhere near enough.
Yeah, and I mean, the question of, like, what is enough and what is the right treatment, and that's what so much money is being, you know, poured into, of understanding whether it's through treating traumatic brain injury or treating sort of psychological impacts of it. But there really is... It's pretty amazing the number of organizations and charities and that want to get people out either to do something to support their families or sending them things when they're overseas, compared to most recently the Vietnam generation, which came around. The VA was pretty awful. Vietnam veterans that started the vet centers, and it was basically by vets and for vets because the VA was so crappy. But there wasn't any of that sort of societal support, so relative to that, there's a ton of support for service members these days, but there's still that deep disconnect of people kind of not knowing what to do. And that's why you end up with what is kind of seen as this vacuous response, like, thank you for your service. And then, but it's just this wide gulf between people who have served and the people at home. And we just keep doing more and more to sort of sanitize war and insulate ourselves from it. You know, look at the casualty figures. 7,000 Americans have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We lost 7,000 on Iwo Jima alone.
Yeah. Right. And it's just, and again, that is a great thing that, you know, not as many people are dying. But it's still very expensive in very many ways. You know, not just the money, but there's, you know, in limbs and in bodies and hearts and souls, 8,000 contractors have been killed in the wars. But then of the, you know, 100,000 security forces in Iraq and Afghanistan have been killed, a couple 100,000 civilians. And then, you know, the however many Taliban or Al-Qaeda or ISIS fighters that America has killed, you know, our kill ratio is enormous.
Right.
Every American that dies, we kill a lot of people.
Right.
And it in some ways desensitizes us here to that, and especially when you start using drones, and it allows us to roam the world doing things in the name of fighting terror, keeping us safe, but it pushes us further and further from that visceral connection to, you know, like World War II, you have Gold Star mothers. If you had someone in service, you have a blue star that people had put in their window. Gold Star, you had a son or daughter killed and, you know, killed in the war.
Right.
That was not an uncommon sight, that there would be a gold star hanging on the window. There's just not as much of that today, and so it makes it very easy for us as a country to do these things. And even the expense, I mean, you have $2 trillion to spend on these wars. That's like $5,000 or $6,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. $5,000. Like, where do you want to spend your chunk of that money? Maybe it went to buying school books for girls in Afghanistan who previously weren't allowed to go to school. That's a good use of the money. Maybe it went to building Iraqi police stations by contractors in D.C. that subcontracted over and over and over again, and then by the time it opens, there's sewage leaking through the floor because it was built so shoddily and it never, and the, you know, the taxpayers dumped millions of dollars into that. Or bullets are cheap. Maybe your $5,000 went to buy a bunch of bullets. And maybe it was the bullets people like Dan used to keep himself and the people around him to protect them. Or maybe it's a traffic checkpoint in Iraq. And there's some soldiers there and there's a car driving towards them with a family inside. And they don't understand what's being said, and it's confusing about the signals that are being given to them. And the people at the checkpoint just were attacked the day before by a suicide car bomber. And they can't afford to wait another second to determine what's going to happen. So the bullets we bought go into the car, and you kill a family. This happens a lot. So the family's dead, and then the people have to live with it. So then there's injuries all around. How it affects the ripples of many, many people.
And there are some people who say that that new ability to distance ourselves, right, is also compromising our moral authority. That they call it the moral compact with our soldiers. We send our very best to do our very worst. We ask you to do all kinds of stuff, and you're willing to do that with the understanding we're not going to just waste your life, right? We're not going to make decisions willy-nilly. But retired Army Lieutenant General David Barno wrote in 2012 about that moral compact and how the all-volunteer military has made it too easy to go to war. It says, today, such profound decisions are all but free of consequences for the American people. When the lives and the deaths of our soldiers no longer personally impact the population at large, have we compromised our moral authority on war? How can we make wartime decisions in good conscience when those paying the price are someone else's kids, but assuredly never our own? One wonders if we would have entered our recent conflicts as quickly or let them drag on so long if our army was filled with draftees drawn from a random swath of families across all segments of America. You know, when you go to the voting booth, is one of the factors in your decision the fact that we're at war and have been at war for 18 years? Probably not, because of that distance we're able to have. And yet, we have people coming back, or even people who haven't left, right? People in, say, Las Vegas operating drones who are able to physically separate themselves, but not morally. You talked about working like a shift, 9 to 5, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other thing of craziness, because the people who do those jobs, they fly them now from several places, but when I had spent time with them, they're at Creech Air Force Base north of Las Vegas, and men and women live in Las Vegas, and they live in, like, nice houses in the suburbs, and their neighbors just see them wearing an Air Force uniform. Oh, they must work at the Air Force Base. And every day they go to work and they fly these like 8 or 12 hour shifts over Afghanistan or over Iraq. And for them, it's just a surreal mashup of war and life, because then a lot of times they might leave and have to go pick up milk at the grocery store.
Go to their kid's baseball game. Right?
Yeah.
And because of the technology, this is up close and personal for them, right? I mean, they can see license plates and faces, and it's not.
Yeah, I sat with them one day. They were doing just a sort of long reconnaissance. They'd just been watching someone to see if it was, they just wanted to see what is sort of, they called it patterns of life, what this person was doing, who his associates were. And they were flying, it was like 5 miles up and 5 miles away. So relatively, line of sight, they're 7 miles from this person. It's 3 o'clock in the morning in Afghanistan. It's the middle of the day in Las Vegas. And the view from the thermal camera looked like we're standing on top of a four-story building. And you could see the chickens and the cows in his courtyard, and he got up to go to the bathroom, went to the side of his house and went to the bathroom. Had no idea someone was watching him. And if he had been, instead, digging a hole in the road and putting a bomb in it, they would have fired a missile at him. And it's not easy for the people doing it, but it's very easy for us. But yet we still own, I mean, it's the vast silent majority in this country that is, you know, we're off doing other things because we have the luxury of doing that, while this minority is off doing things, implementing American foreign policy on our behalf. We still own it. You know, we own all the blood that's spilled. But like you said, if you had national service or something that people knew it was a possibility, and whether it's you're going to be a police officer, or you're going to clear park trails, or you're going to go and fight, but it's a possibility. Yeah, maybe we'd make different decisions beforehand, which is the time to have these conversations, because you start the ball rolling.
Right. Or maybe we'd make the same decision, but at least we would have made the decision, right?
Right.
I mean, this seems much more like war by default.
Yes.
So all this leads to that incredible disconnect when veterans come back. Society is in this whole other place than they are now. But some have found these programs to help deal with that. And you've written about this a lot. So before we watch the video, talk a little bit about these programs and the outdoors and the mountains and how they help people process this.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that Dan had found. So what I met him for was
110% into this, right? I mean, he was full on.
Yeah, and it really seemed like it was going to be something that was going to give him sort of a bridge back home. And it's this idea that it's back in society, but it's in a place where you're out and you have this physical challenge, and kind of mimic some of the better parts of the military or things that they miss of camaraderie and teamwork. You have this sense of mission, we're going to try to get to the top of this mountain, and then there's a little bit of danger, there's a little bit of adrenaline. In a more healthy way, you could get hurt, but it doesn't involve people shooting at you or you having to shoot at or, you know, defend yourself. But there's been a real uptick. I mean, it's been around for a little while. The first person to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail was a World War II vet who told a friend he was going to go walk the army and the war out of his system. So he just went out and walked through the woods for 5 months.
A lot of veterans have written about that inability to express what they've seen, what what they felt, what they went through. Russell Worth Parker in January wrote for the New York Times about his first night back and how he woke his wife up at 2 a.m. I wanted her to see and understand something about the previous 7 months of my life, but I didn't know how to tell her about a 2-year-old child toddling through window glass shattered by an explosive charge, leaving tiny bloody footprints on the polished concrete floor of his home. And I got to think he's not the only person who struggles with trying to explain that, even to loved ones, right, even if they have that support network.
Yeah, and it never was going to be the same, but he would find a place where it was okay, where he could sort of process things and come to terms and just find a new place where he felt comfortable and at home. And some people don't. Dan didn't. You know, Dan, he just forever felt that there wasn't a place for him to fit in. And, you know, with the outdoors, originally it was about the adrenaline and the risk, but then it became more of that sort of considering sort of his existential place in nature and maybe the meditative qualities or gaining perspective. Dan never had that. It was always a substitute for adrenaline. And really, adrenaline probably went back, a mismatch in brain chemicals that went back to his childhood of being under threat and just those stress hormones and then all through the war and then afterwards then fighting and always being at odds with people around him and how people don't understand and getting bar fights all the time. And he could go out and climb mountains and have that risk, but he was always substituting that. So that's the place he never got to.
Yeah, and he'd climb without ropes, he'd climb solo, he would...
Yeah.
It was just all about the adrenaline.
And he, you know, he burned bridges left and right and blew up relationships. And so it's that hard work, and then he was never able to get there. Also because these are these hard cases. He's at the end of the bell curve. He's not the low-hanging fruit for the VA of like, okay, we can work with him a little bit and give him some, you know, coping skills. And
right.
But you break it, you buy it. You know, Dan did a lot of asked for and required work for the country. And yeah, people like him, he's not an outlier. He could have been any one of us if we didn't get the help we needed and didn't have a support network. But just because someone's hard to help doesn't mean you can't. You've got to find a way to help them.
Right.
Because they're that way, because they went and did the work of this country.
What struck me in the story too was, you know, it's very easy to get the perception of VA as just this uncaring monolith. But you talk to his caseworkers who really, really struggled. And yet they did sometimes run up against bureaucracy, right, where, and there again is that irony, the very symptoms of PTSD that he was dealing with push people away, right, the anger, the alcoholism, all the, right, the outbursts also increase that isolation and loneliness, and it's that vicious cycle. Just when they were trying to help Dan, he gets banned from the clinic because of an outburst, right? His caseworker understood what was going on and would have continued to see him, but the rules didn't allow that.
Yeah, he had a narrow window, and it unfortunately closed before he could really get the help he needed, but his psychologist he was working with was convinced that she could have helped him and explained him what was going on in his brain and helped him work through things. But this story, unfortunately, this talks a lot about the problems and a lot about what leads up to it. But there is a lot of great work being done, a lot of really dedicated people at the VA. And there's new sort of treatment protocols and ways of approaching more sort of nuanced ways of understanding sort of the life journeys of people and everything that they bring to it, that it's not just maybe this one traumatic event.
Again, even though we've dedicated many more resources, the VA says 20% of the 2.7 million have PTSD. That's 500,000 people with PTSD, and that's not counting that over 50 age group who are also dealing with trauma. That is overwhelming numbers, and that's not going to be cheap.
No, and I forget what the numbers are, but I think it's 30 or 40% of the veterans who have died by suicide. less than half have received VA health services. So they're not within their, it's not that they were receiving VA care and that was failing them. They weren't receiving VA care for whatever reason, maybe by choice, that they just weren't reaching out.
Right.
So that's another, yeah, it's a broad pool of need. And we're just talking about veterans, but, and we've been talking a lot about combat, but I mean, it's sort of a deeply human issue that we all probably, whether we're aware of it or not, have a lot of people in our lives that struggle with things that at various times, whether they put voice to it or have someone that they can reach out and talk to about, have struggled with that idea of like, it would just be easier if I just wasn't around.
Right.
Or if I just ended it.
Thank you again, Brian.
Thanks, Tim.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Steve Miller for organizing this event, and Donald David for facilitating our recording of America at War for broadcast. Our music is by Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. The web version of this program is produced by Loyal Vandenberg. Until next time, thank you for listening.